Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. It's Here and Now. President Biden heads to Pittsburgh today to unveil a sprawling $2 trillion infrastructure plan. It wouldn't just fix bridges and roads. It would also expand access to broadband internet, upgrade schools, and fund clean power. But the ambitious plan doesn't yet have traction in Washington, where Biden may need Republicans to pass the bill. We're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
So this bill goes far beyond what we normally think of as infrastructure. Just how big of an economic transformation would this really be?
Well, that is the goal, is to transform the U.S. economy and repair some of what has been broken by the pandemic and some of the brokenness that was revealed by it. And it includes things, as you say, that are traditional, like roads, bridges, transit, rural broadband, which is widely popular, but also things like fixing sewer and water systems to resolve issues like what happened in Flint, Michigan, or bolstering the electricity grid to prevent what happened in Texas earlier this year.
Yeah.
Schools, hospitals, housing, and then also really focusing in, they're calling this a jobs plan, but really focusing in on areas that have been previously underserved or not quite helped by previous infrastructure efforts. So putting an emphasis on trying to get manufacturers to move into areas where there have been a loss of coal jobs, or trying to reconnect neighborhoods that were cut off by highway building in the past.
Mm. So infrastructure spending has been popular with Republicans and Democrats before. How about now? Will Biden be able to get this done? Can he get the votes he needs?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those things that used to be a rare island of bipartisan cooperation.
Right.
And it's not clear yet whether this will be that island anymore. The challenge is that this is sweeping and wide ranging, but that is also an asset in that there is something for everybody in this legislation, something for every senator and House member to bring home and, heck, get their name on a bridge. So it will be we have to watch how the politics here play out and whether Democrats end up having to go it alone again like they did with the COVID relief bill.
Then there's the eye-popping $2 trillion price tag on this one. How does the president say he'll pay for it, Tamara?
Yeah, so the way that they are proposing to pay for it is by rolling back some of the tax cuts on businesses that were in the tax proposal, in the tax bill that was passed by Republicans and signed by President Trump in 2017. So that top corporate tax rate would go up to 28%. Now, that is still historically low compared to the past. It's about halfway back to where it was before the Trump tax cuts. One thing that's interesting and not in this is raising taxes on wealthy individuals, which is something that had been discussed. And also Democrats and their allies are making an argument that, hey, maybe don't get hung up on paying for this dollar for dollar, because infrastructure investment can pay for itself by creating efficiencies and also creating jobs. But that is unlikely to be an argument that is accepted by Republicans in Congress who are going to express concerns about the debt and deficit as they did when President Obama was in office.
Hmm. About a minute left here, Tam. Some progressive Democrats say this proposal does not go far enough. What more do they want?
Well, part of what is going on here is that the White House says this is only part one, that there will be part two as well, and that that will include more of a focus on sort of the human side of infrastructure, if you will, things like free community college or universal pre-K or paid family leave, some of these other things that have been holding back the economy, but do not certainly fit into the traditional definition of infrastructure. And progressives want that, and also more on the environment.
Mm. Well, the infrastructure plan is here. We will keep watching. Tamara Keith is NPR's White House correspondent. Thanks, Tam.
You're welcome.
We are getting our first look at a detention facility overcrowded with children on the U.S.-Mexico border. Yesterday, journalists were allowed inside a temporary tent structure in Donna, Texas. It's supposed to hold 250 people, but right now, more than 4,000 people are crammed inside. Many are children, traveling alone. They're supposed to be processed there before going to a government-run shelter and then eventually united with a family member. Joining us now is Democratic Congressman Vicente Gonzalez of Texas. He represents a district near the border. Congressman, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
You recently called President Biden's immigration policies catastrophic. So when you see these latest images from Texas, what are you thinking?
Yeah, well, let me clear that up. I didn't call his immigration plan catastrophic. I called the fact that people were coming across the border, processed and released in the middle of a pandemic within my community, potentially catastrophic. Overall, I think his plan is a good immigration plan and certainly much better than what we had in the past administration. Obviously, the Biden administration is dealing with this in a very humane, compassionate way. But clearly, this administration has their hands full. And at the same time, we're in the middle of a pandemic. And I think the pressure they're on under the circumstances, they've done quite a job. But there's still much more that can be done. And what I'm trying to do is have ideas that are solutions to what's happening. What's happening on our southern border is nothing more than a result of our broken immigration system.
The administration is trying to fix this. They've started housing some migrants in hotels. As you know, some children have been moved to convention centers in Dallas and in San Diego. Is that working? Is that a good solution to this problem?
I think it's a temporary solution, and it's a way to process them as fast as possible and with the intention of getting them into the homes of their family members as fast as possible.
So let's get to some of the other potential solutions here. What should the president be doing to solve this problem?
First of all, we have to have a very clear message to Central America that it's not safe to make this 2,000-mile trek, and we should have a system in place where people can ask for asylum in a safe way, in a safe zone, in their home country or their neighboring country, and create much like the camps that we see on our southern border here within my district, these tent facilities. We should have facilities like that in southern Mexico, in Guatemala, in Honduras, and along the way for people to check in, register, and try to have an expedited asylum hearing. And if they qualify, they should be able to get on a plane and fly into the United States. And we need to have a holistic approach to our immigration system. We need to have a robust guest worker program alongside with people asking for asylum. And we need to find ways for people who are here already to be able to have some kind of legal status.
So you're calling for migrants' asylum applications to be processed in their home country. That is something the Biden administration has said it's working on and trying to revive. But we also know that the president has tapped Vice President Kamala Harris with addressing the root cause of migration from Central American countries.
That's right.
The U.S. has been sending money to those countries for years with questionable results. What will be different this time? How would that work?
What I hope will be different this time, that those investments just don't go to NGOs or governmental entities in those countries, and the money ends up being squandered and not invested properly. My idea is to invest in areas where people are likely to migrate from. If you take Guatemala, for example, people don't migrate from all over the country. They migrate from certain pockets within the country. And we need to have a surgical approach and go into those areas and figure out what we can do to create stability on the ground and to have permanent investments that create employment and create conditions for people to want to stay in their home country.
Do you think the White House was caught off guard?
Well, I don't think that this was plan A for them, that they were going to have this massive surge coming from Central America. But this is what I say, the unintended consequence of having a compassionate human being in the White House. It sends a message without them sending the message that, hey, we no longer have this hateful anti-immigrant president in the White House. We're now welcome to go. But I think that their communication has been a lot more firm in telling people, hey, hold off, stay home. We're going to figure a way to do this properly, and I think that's what you're seeing. Now, it's not going to be a flip of a switch. This can't be done overnight, but I do think that in the first 6 months of the Biden administration, you're going to see them have this totally under control.
Well, plus, you know, Republicans are not going to miss this opportunity and haven't missed this opportunity to pile on the president for what's been happening at the border. Do you think everything that's happened since he's taken office will be a liability for your party in next year's midterms and perhaps later in 2024?
I think people have a very clear view of what's happening. Now, I had 18 or 19 Republican senators show up to my district last week to rant and rave about what's happening on the border. And my question to them is, where were you in 2019 when kids were being ripped off mothers' arms and caged and families were divided? They all of a sudden had this softened heart to show up and criticize the border. Why weren't they doing it at the time? And what I've told folks, don't show up to my border without solutions. That certainly is not helpful to the American people.
Vicente Gonzalez, a Democrat representing a district along the U.S.-Mexico border in Texas. Congressman, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
President Biden is arguing that during a pandemic, this is the moment to reimagine and rebuild a new economy. And he wants to do it starting with a $2 trillion infrastructure plan he's unveiling today in Pittsburgh. But will it be politically doable in a divided country? Just this morning, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce called Biden's proposed corporate tax hikes to pay for it dangerously misguided. Our political strategists join us now. We've got Matt Mikowiak, a Republican. Matt, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Good to have you. And there's also Jamal Simmons here, a Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, happy to be here.
So, Jamal, this is a big day for the White House. It's also a very big price tag. What do you think this infrastructure plan is signaling about the direction the president is trying to take the country?
Well, it's more than signaling. I think this infrastructure plan is going to put on the table things that we've been, we meaning the American public, have been clamoring for a decade and a half at least, maybe a couple decades. They're going to spend money, I think $115 billion in highway and bridges, 20,000 miles of highway, the 10 most economically significant bridges, and the 10,000 worst bridges around the country. Everybody's got a bridge story. They're going to fix lead pipes, which we know from Flint was a huge problem. And my sort of pet issue, which is around high-speed broadband. They're going to put $100 billion into making sure 100% of the country is covered by broadband. This is a huge deal. It's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to put people to work, and it's going to fix a lot of problems in the country.
Matt? What do you think? I mean, everything that Jamal just said, he laid out what this bill would focus on, roads, bridges, lead pipes, high-speed internet for everybody. Those are pretty popular things around the country. Are Republicans on board?
No, they're not going to be on board with a $2 trillion plan that has massive tax increases in it. It's the wrong time to raise taxes coming out of COVID. It's pretty shocking, honestly, that they would even propose massive tax increases at a time where the economy has been very weak, where people have been feeling desperation around the country, where restaurants have been decimated, hospitality, the arts. You could look at so many industries that have been hurt. Now, look, when you spend $2 trillion, you're going to do some good things. Jamal pointed to some of them, certainly, and our infrastructure in our country does need work. And this is one of the failings of the Trump administration. He talked a big game about infrastructure. It used to be a joke, about Infrastructure Week time and time and time again. He never put a plan together. He never found a pathway forward. And honestly, the distance between what Republicans want to do, which is leverage private dollars with public-private partnerships, and what Democrats want to do, which is raise taxes and do massive spending through the federal government, I think is unbridgeable. You know, I hope they can get to a deal that's in the middle that's good for the country, but it seems to me like they're going to be too far apart, and I think these tax increases are a non-starter.
Jamal, I do want to give you a chance to respond to the price tag and raising taxes, but first, Matt, go a little bit deeper in what you think it would take to get Republicans' support. It sounds like you're saying there's a different philosophy on how to raise the money to do this.
Yeah, there is a huge philosophical difference. And keep in mind, I mean, something like 95 or 97% of all Republicans in the House and Senate have signed a pledge not to ever vote for a tax increase. So that in and of itself presents a major problem. But this plan would almost have to be revenue neutral to gain significant Republican support. But I think there's just a fundamental breakdown between what Republicans see as a realistic pathway, which is not making it entirely publicly funded, but using public-private partnerships. The Democrats haven't really shown a lot of interest in that model being the primary method for infrastructure. They want to do massive spending choose the projects from the federal side, add all these other things that they want to do. These are about Democratic priorities, and they're going to try to deliver that. We'll see where they have the votes. They have a very narrow majority in the House and a 50-50 tie in the Senate, so this is going to be very tricky.
Jamal, the president is proposing to raise corporate taxes from 21% to 28%. But, you know, that is still lower than what they were at the start of President Trump's term. So how are Democrats going to sell this? Can they get by what Matt has just described, that resistance from Republicans?
Well, what may happen is this package gets broken up into two, maybe three pieces. One of those pieces may have a tax price tag in it that the Republicans don't want to be for. But another piece of it may be something Republicans can vote for. We'll see. But I listen to Matt talk, and it's like, as George W. Bush would say, fool me once, shame on me, don't fool me. The last time President Obama was in office, he proposed what we call the Infrastructure Bank, which was a public-private partnership infrastructure plan. He couldn't get the Republicans to sign up on board because Mitch McConnell refused to do a deal. So if the Democrats want to spend all their time chasing Republicans, and I think bipartisanship is good, and we should try to get Republicans on board if possible, but you just can't not fix the country because Republicans want to play politics. And I think that's the calculation going on inside the Biden White House. Let's get something done for the people, and then the people can decide if they like it or not, and they'll either vote for Democrats or not in 2 years.
Jamal, we're not there yet, but this conversation that we're having makes me think that it's possible, and some people are talking about this already, that to get this through, we're talking about budget reconciliation again. Again, no Republican support. Is that a good idea? If it came to that, is that something Democrats should be willing to do?
You know, after the way the Republicans denied Obama his Supreme Court pick, the way Republicans pushed through, got rid of the filibuster in order to get Supreme Court justices passed, all the ways Republicans tried to bend and break the system to make it work, it's so rich to hear Republicans complain now about Democrats looking for ways to get their agenda passed. Elections do have consequences. Look, once you do it, I'm sure Republicans, if they get back in charge, they're going to try to do it again. But the question is, the issues on the table are so important. Americans are hungering for getting these things fixed in the country. They're also hungering for getting the wealth inequality gap closed and making sure not just the richest 1% participate, but that everybody in the country gets a chance to enjoy the fruit of our labor. That is what the Democrats are up to. And if we can do that, I think that the Biden administration will do a lot to making the country work and holding this country together and not seeing more January 6th uprisings.
Well, look, I think that was a productive conversation, and I do want to move on. We're going to have a chance to talk about infrastructure for weeks, I presume. Mm-hmm. There's another ambitious bill that we need to get to. When Congress gets back from recess, Senate Democrats want to join the House in passing a sweeping voting rights bill. There's a lot in this bill, but among other things, it would include national voter registration, mail-in voting standards, nonpartisan redistricting commissions, and big changes to campaign finance laws. Matt, you weigh in. Where's this headed?
Well, I mean, it's passed the House, as I understand it, and it's now, head to the Senate. We're going to see if Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona, Joe Manchin from West Virginia, perhaps John Tester from Montana, ultimately hold out because the Democrats can't lose even one vote to still pass it. Look, there's a huge gulf between what Republicans believe is appropriate on election law and what Democrats believe is appropriate. Republicans oppose ballot harvesting. Republicans, oppose anything that makes it easy to vote illegally. Republicans support voter ID. Republicans oppose nationalizing elections. Elections are conducted by states, by counties, not by the federal government. And those are views that the Democrats strongly disagree with. So it seems to me the Democrats like the results in 2020 and certainly with the Georgia Senate runoffs, where emergency rules were used to expand voting access. They like those results. They want to make those rules permanent. Republicans don't want that. They don't believe that these emergency powers should be used now that we're getting through COVID. So there's a huge ideological difference there, and we'll see where it heads. I think the Senate is going to be very, very, very close, but the stakes on this are extremely high.
Matt, you mentioned illegal voting. I just got to say, there is really no evidence of illegal voting happening at a very wide scale in this country. I got to say that. But you did also mention something important that I want Jamal to weigh in on, which is that for the most part, state elections have been up to the states. Do you think this is territory for the federal government, Jamal?
It is territory for the federal government. We established that with the Voting Rights Act in the 60s. And what happened is the Supreme Court gutted that Voting Rights Act and got rid of preclearance. And so what we've seen since preclearance has gone away is a raft of legislation coming out of the states that has been ratcheting back voting rights for citizens. And we've had a hard time as a country to combat that. You know, we talk about federalizing versus states. What about the local elections? And what you saw in the Georgia bill that just passed is the Georgia state legislature has decided it alone will have the authority to usurp the power of a locally elected election board in a state. So a city like Atlanta, like Fulton County, where majority black, if they pick an election board and they have an election and they like the election, the state of Georgia can come in and say, not so fast, and change it all and take over that election board. I think those are the kind of things that the 72 African-American executives were in the New York Times writing about this morning, saying that we have got to stand up for our core principle as Americans, that voting should be something everybody has access to, is fair, and it cannot be corrupted by a conservative try to take over because they don't like election results. They didn't like what happened in last year.
This week the New Yorker obtained some audio of Kyle McKenzie. This is a research director for the Koch Run advocacy group Stand Together. He was giving a presentation to conservatives about how hard it is for Republicans to message against the voting rights bill that passed the House this month. It's known as HR1. Let's listen.
The most worrisome part is that conservatives were actually as supportive as the general public was when they read the neutral description of HR1.
Matt, I think that's important. We've got less than a minute. What do you think? Republicans actually were supportive of that language.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with the, whatever he's citing specifically. All these things depend on, you know, basically what the language that's used in the polling and in the questions and how they're asked. You know, I think sending federal dollars to fund, fund political campaigns, that's really problematic. Obviously, the Republicans and Democrats disagree on whether convicted felons all over the country should have access to legal voting. That's been a state by state issue up to this point. Elections integrity, election security, those are issues there. Yeah. There are a lot of issues here. I just think there's a huge divide between the parties.
Lots more to
voting
talk about. Matt McCobiak and Jamal
voting
Simmons. I got to run, Jamal. So sorry. I got to run. Thank you so much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
How is COVID changing the college experience? What's driving the increase in crossings at the border? Why did Colorado's gun laws fail to prevent a mass shooting there? Listen for answers, backstory, and analysis beyond the day's headlines on Consider This from NPR.
Reno, Nevada has become the staging ground for a $1.3 million experiment in mental health. Facing expiring coronavirus relief funds, Reno's government proposed using the money to offer virtual therapy services to its residents through the app Talkspace. The plan faced criticism from local therapists who argued that a mostly text-based therapy was no replacement for in-person mental health services. But the deal was approved in December. Let's check in with the current state of the experiment in Reno with Mario Aguilar, a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Mario, this is a text-based therapy. Tell us a bit about how Talkspace works.
Yeah, it's a therapy app. You download it, answer a few questions, and then you're connected with the therapist. From there, your communication proceeds mostly over text, although depending on your plan, you can have live video sessions either once a week or once a month. And actually, the Reno deal provides once a month live video.
Mm. So every resident in Reno is allowed free access to this, except children, right? So if I'm a resident in Reno, how do I sign up?
So you go to Talkspace.com/Reno. You can simply use your phone's location services, and it'll register that you're within the city, and then you can sign up.
Mario, these therapists on the Talkspace app, are they in Nevada? Are they out of state?
They are licensed in the state of Nevada, but there's no way of knowing where exactly they're located. Talkspace made an effort to reach out to a number of local therapists, offering them a $500 bonus to sign up for the platform, but most of the therapists I talked to scoffed at the rates that Talkspace offers.
Mm. Talkspace has never offered this kind of service to an entire city before. So, Mario, tell us how bad the situation in Reno is with regard to mental health, that the mayor of the city would spend more than $1 million on this sort of experimental technology.
The genesis of this is that the mayor lost a couple of family members in a relatively short period of time last year and was devastated and sought out local therapy services and ultimately found that she couldn't get in anywhere within, I think, 4 to 6 weeks, which is actually pretty typical. On top of that, the coronavirus has made things much worse. And in Nevada in general, there is a very high prevalence of mental health issues as well as relatively low access to care.
Therapists in Reno express real concern about this sort of app-based therapy. What are they saying?
When they first heard about the deal at the end of November, they were kind of blindsided. It was all negotiated behind closed doors, and they felt as though being the providers in the local community who are dealing with the issues each day, they should have been consulted about what the best solution was. They, being local business owners, were pretty adamant that the money should be spent locally and not sent out of state, and also that the money should be spent sort of developing some kind of local infrastructure that would be sustainable beyond when the Talkspace deal expires at the end of this year. On top of that, there's sort of this deep suspicion, I think, among many professional therapists about apps like Talkspace. There's concern that they are sort of therapy light, and also that the effectiveness of chat therapy hasn't really been proven. Talkspace has some studies which show that its system works, but there's still a lot of skepticism and the jury's still out.
That was Mario Aguilar, a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, on his article about the city of Reno, Nevada, offering text-based therapy to its residents. Mario, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ten years after the start of the Syrian civil war, it's hard to believe the humanitarian situation could get any worse, but that's exactly what is happening. The situation is especially bad in the notorious Al-Hol camp, which is home to more than 60,000 people. It's a complex, chaotic, and often violent place because some ISIS supporters and ISIS victims are living there together. They filled the camp after the U.S.-backed Kurdish forces defeated the group in northern Syria 2 years ago. But that did not end the war. In recent days, Kurdish authorities arrested a number of suspected ISIS followers in the camp. Fabrizio Carboni is Middle East director of the International Committee of the Red Cross, and he was part of the Red Cross team that visited the Al-Hol camp last week. He joins us from Geneva. Fabrizio, describe what you saw there.
You mainly see children. And it's quite disturbing, you know, to see this camp in the middle of nowhere, in desertic area. You know, it's a frontline, heavy military presence. And you see mainly children. Yeah, it's 2 years that are there with pretty much nothing.
Describe the living conditions as you saw them, Fabrizio.
It's a camp made of tents. So you need to know that in this area, when it's summer, it's very, very hot. You don't have shades, you don't have trees. And during the winter, it's very cold. When I visited the camp last week, it was raining and windy. The result is that a meaningful number of tents were just, you know, collapsed, or you had mud inside the tents. And that's the only thing they have.
And so when you were talking about a military presence in the camp, what were you referring to specifically?
This camp is guarded because you have also a high level of violence in the camp. You know, since the beginning of the year, I think we had around 40 people killed inside the camp. You know, from one day to another, you have a small town of 60,000, 68,000 people. Peculiar background, they're associated directly or indirectly to the Islamic State group. This camp is on a is on a very unstable area, which can be considered as a front line. You have this camp, you have violence, you have people who want to leave, you have violence between the people in this camp, and there you have kids.
How much influence would you say ISIS has in this camp as it stands today?
You know, what does ISIS mean today? You can have criminal dynamics, you know, criminality. You can have tribal dimensions. You have, I think it's as humanitarian operator who have to work in such a violent environment, which requires a good understanding of what's happening around us, to label this Islamic State group, it's not good enough.
It's broader than that.
It's more complex and broader than that. You know, I know that sometimes it's easier, it explains a lot of things, or it gives the impression to explain a lot of things, but actually when you are confronted with this reality, it doesn't.
Fabrizio, the United Nations and the European Union hosted a donor conference in Brussels this week on Syria specifically. And as you well know, aid money was already dropping before the pandemic hit the world economy so hard. How concerned are you about the flow of aid money and that it's going to dry up?
Oh, it's very, very worrying, because if you look at the data available today, you know, 90% of Syrians, 90% of Syrians live below the international poverty line, which is $1.5. So
90%? 90%?
90%, yes. You know, the feeling you have when you are in Syria, it's, you know, I go there 2-3 times per year in the last 4 years. And you have the feeling that it's a permanent year zero. Mm. You know, you had the feeling that the battles just stopped yesterday. Mm. Because not just a city or neighborhood, but the whole country destroyed.
And so I would imagine that the people of Syria feel like the world maybe has forgotten them.
Yes, for sure. There is this feeling, they seem to be abandoned. There is a lack of hope. You know, we often talk about, you know, the light at the end of the tunnel. I mean, in this case, I'm not even sure there is a tunnel today. So the humanitarian support is key, is critical. This being said, you know, the solution is not more humanitarian assistance. The solution is a political one. It's to address the root causes of this violence for the kids and their mothers. Find a way for the ones who are foreigners to go back home, to be repatriated. And it's a call we have for states, is to take their responsibility and bring their citizens back, women and children. So, yes, there is a dire situation. The humanitarian actors are helping the country and the Syrian people, wherever they are in the country, to stay afloat. But we are not addressing the situation. We are not solving the situation. Yes. Only politics can do that.
What is needed is a political solution as much as a humanitarian one. Point taken.
And political courage. That's something which is, in our view, missing. I'm sorry to go back to the camp of Al-Hol, but as we're talking about people and children and women who are related to the Islamic State group, you know, we describe this group as beyond humanity, which prevent the capacity of states to reach out, to show not even empathy, but to agree that even those people that have been described as the ultimate reincarnation of evil, and they contributed to it, I'm not excluding this, but we put them so much beyond humanity that after it's hard to show the basic principle of humanity, which define modern states today in the world.
Fabrizio Carboni is Middle East Director for International Committee of the Red Cross. Fabrizio, thank you for your work and for sharing it with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Monday's vicious beating of a 65-year-old Filipino woman in New York is just one of a string of violent attacks against Asians across the country over the past year. The coalition Stop AAPI Hate reports that there have been nearly 3,800 incidents of racism against Asian Americans documented in the U.S. since March of 2020. For many Asian American families right now, the focus is on staying safe and connected. And many young adults, like YR Media's Amber Lee, are trying to spend more time supporting their parents.
I grew up surrounded by the smell of donuts and coffee. My parents are Asian immigrants who have owned a donut shop in the San Francisco Bay Area for over 20 years, and it was the center of my childhood. My sister and I would sit around at the donut shop and do our homework. Years later, as an adult, I'm still there often, helping out or eating dinner with them. My parents work late nights, sometimes returning home in the early hours of the morning. They're busy working the register, hand-cutting dough, and using heavy machinery to fry the donuts. When the news about the shootings in Atlanta broke, I kept refreshing the Find My Friends app to check their location. I was relieved when I heard the front door open. The next day, I tagged along with my mom while she ran some errands. She could tell I was worried. After a long walk, she threw her arm over me, asking, "What do you want to eat? I'll get you whatever you want so you can feel better." I smiled and I told her I was okay, but she knew. The next day, I found a basket of strawberries in the fridge, my favorite fruit. As a family, we don't talk much about the recent acts of anti-Asian violence, probably because we don't want to live in fear, although my parents have started closing their shop earlier. And while that gives me some peace of mind, I still find myself checking on them until I fall asleep at night. Especially knowing the attacks against Asian elders in the Bay Area are continuing. There is no doubt that these incidents have brought a lot of emotions, but they're also bringing us closer. My parents are sharing more of their stories about their childhood in Vietnam and Cambodia. How my great-grandmother would wake my mom up at 5 a.m. to do chores, just when the air was finally cool enough for her to fall asleep. Or how there's this fruit that they've never found here, but grew on many trees back home. There are a lot of kids like me who grew up playing at our immigrant parents' nail salons, restaurants, laundromats, and stores. Along with those childhood memories, we also carry the worry for our parents. Those feelings never really go away, especially right now. For Here and Now, I'm Amber Lee.
Soon enough, we hope, the pandemic will be history, and museum curators are already preparing for that day. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History has started collecting artifacts from the past year, including the empty vial that contained the first dose of vaccine administered into the U.S. New York nurse Sandra Lindsay got that shot in December. Her vaccination card, scrubs, and hospital ID badge are now also in the museum's collection. So is Dr. Anthony Fauci's 3D SARS-CoV-2 model that he brought on TV in the early days of the pandemic. Anthea Hartig is director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Welcome. Welcome. Thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Peter.
Yeah, sure. So it was last April when the National Museum of American History put together a rapid response team to start collecting artifacts from this pandemic. How did you know to do that when this thing was only just starting?
Well, we're fortunate in that our relationships with the CDC and the National Institute of Health probably have never been stronger. So we started to track this new virus with them. You know, there are some things in a historian's mind where you know you're living through history. You're kind of in the grist mill of history. Like you can feel it, the gears turning. And we knew this was one of them. We set out to assess and document simultaneously the scientific and medical events, as well as the effects and responses in the areas of business, work, politics, culture, labor, gender, and went from there.
Well, it's a huge pool to choose from, right? I mean, I mentioned the vaccine vial and Dr. Fauci's COVID-19 model.
Mm-hmm.
What are you trying to accomplish when you decide what it is you're going to go after to acquire?
The precept that I laid out for you, kind of our guiding philosophy, was to collect in areas where we had strength, but also to try and make sure that we didn't miss any opportunity to work with communities. We created a special email address. People would email us saying, I have a sign that we made in my restaurant saying that we'd be back in 2 weeks. Do you want me to keep it? And so it's a beautiful way to both engage communities who, of course, are people are going through so much, but also to try and get at that which is most ephemeral that will help us remember these times next year, 10 years from now, or 50 years from now.
What else do you have that you're proud of, or maybe, you know, that epitomizes this struggle of the past year?
Oh, sure. Which struggle, right? The cascading crises. And we did really start to frame it as the number of pandemics, especially viral and racial, after the killing of George Floyd and on Memorial Day. So we expanded that rapid response ideology, and we collected and documented the Black Lives Matter movement, especially through the lens of Lafayette Square. So we collected together banners and the new street signs that were put up in Black Lives Matter Plaza here in Washington by Mayor Bowser. We collected a full range of protest signs. We had already started to collect the election. So we pivoted, you know, the overused word, but we really did have to pivot that stream of collecting too. And then we tried to make as much sense of it as we could as an aggregate, knowing that we won't be able to make full sense of it, that we will need a bit of time. But nor did we want to hide behind the curtain that sometimes historians do and say, oh, we'll wait 50 years to see if it's historic.
Well, right? Exactly. So, you're doing this as the events are
live.
Still unfolding, right? I mean, this is happening as we speak. So what do you do with all that stuff? How do you even start to make sense of it? And present it to the public in a way that will honor what happened.
Just before the pandemic hit, we had finished a strategic plan and a new interpretive plan and collecting plan, which sounds like just kind of can be boring plans. But these positioned us in ways to think about the intersectionality of our work. You know, how do different groups and peoples and forces and agencies work to shape the world we're in now, and how do we see the past as not inevitable, but a series of choices that people were making? So if you see it kind of in people's choices that they make every day, it does help you understand then a little bit more on how to collect in the moment, you know, making this history alive and vibrant, and also making sure that people have ways to see themselves reflected in it.
Is there something you don't have that you really want that you're trying to save? And I don't know if you can tell me, I mean, maybe you're in negotiations for something that's important to you.
There are a number of things that, yeah, I probably can't tell you. But what I can tell you is that we're collecting a remarkable banner from a march in San Francisco's Chinatown that says, fight the virus, not the people, in English and Chinese and Korean, and Japanese, actually. And in a photograph of, you know, elders and youth holding the banner together in San Francisco's Chinatown. This one is resonating with me really powerfully right now.
Anthea Hardick is director of the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History with a big, big job in front of her. Thank you so much.
No, thank you so much, Peter. You take good care.
You too. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This is Here and Now.